Hello and welcome to How Green is Your Deal, a podcast about Europe's path to climate neutrality. This podcast is part of Green Deal Net, a Jean Monnet network that brings together research and teaching on EU climate and sustainability governance. The climate transition will require action on all levels of society. To get everyone on board, climate intermediaries can help link together different actors and levels. In this episode, we are going to focus on an often overlooked group of these go-betweens, the Muslim climate intermediaries. To do so, we are joined by Paul Tobin, a professor in politics at the University of Manchester, and Zahrina Ahmad, a researcher with great expertise on the environmental sustainability of individuals from underrepresented groups, also at the University of Manchester. Together, they have recently published the article, The Religions Are Engaging, Tick, Well Done, The Invisibilization and Instrumentalization of Muslim Climate Intermediaries in Policy Studies, which, as usual, you will find in our show notes. Hi, Paul and Zahrina. Thank you so much for being here today and sharing your expertise on this interesting and important topic. I'm very glad to have you both here. Can you say a little bit more about what actually climate intermediaries are?
Absolutely. Hi, Jana, and hello, listeners as well. The article that Zahrina and I are going to be talking about today is part of a wider special issue co-edited with Jarla Tosun and Faye Farstadt, which is all about climate intermediaries. And it's a special issue in policy studies that you can access if you want to look at it. And it has six articles within it, and our article is just one of those. But the special issue is all about climate intermediaries because of course, there's a lot of research that has existed on the role of intermediaries in policy and in sustainable transitions and lots of other areas. But whilst bringing this special issue together, we realised there wasn't quite a specific definition that was around climate intermediaries in particular, by which we mean actors that are going to be go-betweens, bringing together different types of actors or different levels of governance, either directly or indirectly affecting stakeholders' performance or goals. And the reason that we say that is just because there's a lot of literature that talks about intermediaries perhaps being state bodies. And we really wanted to bring a broader definition that also encapsulated certain patterns across different types of actors. So rather than being state actors, they could be faith groups, for example, or political parties. And we were particularly interested in this special issue on types of actors that actually don't exist for climate change reasons. So yes, we could look at environmental NGOs a lot in our research, and ENGOs are extremely important, and I'm working on a project at the moment working with some ENGOs, but they exist for climate change reasons, and that would bring its own dynamics with it. And so we wanted to examine types of actors that exist for other reasons as well, such as faith groups, as well as those that are such new types of actors like funding bodies that they haven't been researched as much. So that's what the special issue as a whole is all about. And the key thing to take away is that a climate intermediary is a role that an actor plays. So any single individual or organization can be a climate intermediary. And they're defined by their role. And so they could have multiple different roles. They could be a climate intermediary in certain situations and then be at the end of the chain in others. And that's one of the things that we've hopefully tried to get across with our special issue.
So it's really a very broad concept when we think about it like this, including both individuals, different types of groups, but then also perhaps government levels. So really like a wide encompassing aspect. And I think it's interesting that you then also look specifically, as you said, at those that are not by nature, you know, climate or environmental related. As you said, one of the groups you looked at in a special issue and specifically in your article were these faith-based actors like Muslim climate intermediaries. What are some of their specific characteristics?
What was interesting for me is that a lot of communities and individuals were being excluded, and not just because they're marginalized, because some were quite powerful organizations and institutes like faith-based organizations. So in Scotland, we have eco-congregations, and across the UK, you have SCEAC, who both have a very powerful voice when it comes to talking about faith and environmentalism. But what I noticed was the lack of voice from any other faith groups. And that led to me thinking, well, why is that? Why are other faith groups being marginalized? And obviously, there's structural racism that exists in our society, and there's Islamophobia that exists in society, which further marginalizes groups and actors, which potentially have the power to be very influential, with a lot of power in terms of influencing both individual behavior change, influencing where money is invested, influencing policy change. So, you know, they are influential in many areas. And many people in the UK, even though the UK sees itself as being secular, still follow a faith of one kind or another. So it is a place for people to go where it gives them hope as well as guidelines and regulation on their everyday life. So if you think about behaviour change as well, which is something that gets branded a lot when we think about policy, and something that I struggle with in terms of that, you know, there's too much emphasis on behaviour change. But if we think about behaviour change in individuals and some of the key nudge factors that are played in behaviour change, faith can be one of those. And it's like, well, why are we not including more faith groups within that behaviour change and nudge factors as well? So faith has a huge role in communities, but also, as Paul has alluded to, in terms of like policy change and putting pressure on policy and putting pressure on governments to change, putting pressure on people, a society as a whole, to actually move forward and do things in a much more progressive, more environmentalist way.
I think that's so interesting, like, you know, hearing you talk about how faith can be used as like a guidance for your life and what the role can be of these organizations in, you know, trying to get people maybe to live more sustainable. But then also on the other side of things, that they can then also have an influence on policy because they are, of course, big groups. Something you already mentioned a little bit is that there are some differences between different types of faith-based actors, where Muslim actors might face some particular obstacles or challenges to really fulfilling this role of climate intermediaries. Can you talk a little bit more about those?
Absolutely. So I'm coming at this project as a scholar of climate change politics and often European Union politics. And Jana, that's how we've known each other and co-authored together as well. But this was a very new project for me. And so hearing Muslim voices was a very important part of that research process. So we have 21 different interviewees who spoke to us, two of whom aren't Muslim individuals, and they are instead multi-interfaith partner actors that work with Muslim communities. But we found two main strands of obstacles for Muslim communities' involvement from our interviewees, and they're both within the title of our article. One is invisibilization, and the other is instrumentalization. So let's take those one at a time, just to talk about what we exactly mean. So by invisibilization, we are talking about individuals perhaps wanting to be active members of meetings or strategies to fill in new ideas and suggest solutions. And yet when the time comes to participate in policy design, being invisibilized or not quite marginalized necessarily, but simply just not even seen. We had one interviewee, for example, say that they had a master's degree, and yet when they went to go and try and shape some climate strategies, one of the biggest obstacles was simply having people not even expect them to be able to speak English. And so there is an assumption that leads to Muslim voices being hidden during the policy process, often with state actors. We also saw instrumentalization, by which we mean more like tokenism, bordering on exploitation. And that's where the title of our paper comes from. It's a direct quotation, because we wanted our interviewees' voices to be throughout the whole piece, including in the title. So the religions are engaging, tick, well done. And that was said in a way of suggesting, okay, well, it's just a box ticking exercise. And actually, we don't necessarily care about Muslim voices. We just want to tick to say that religions are somewhere involved in the climate policy process. And so this instrumentalization, again, just like invisibilization, can lead to really ineffective and ineffectual policy design. So, for example, there can be funding incentive schemes for renewables for mosques, but mosques are unable to apply for these, depending on their particular faith and denomination, because of the interest payments that are involved, which would be unacceptable to some Muslim communities. And so we see the design of policies taking a sweeping assumption about the needs of citizens and not actually taking into account the actual different needs and priorities and, of course, skills and opportunities that these voices want to provide. As Zarina was saying, faith groups are a huge part of many countries, particularly the UK. And in the UK, Muslim communities are the second largest faith group behind Christians, totaling about 2.5 million people. So to create policies regarding something as urgent as climate change that actively invisibilizes or instrumentalizes 2.5 million citizens is the last thing that policy designers, I would expect, wish to be doing.
Mm-hmm. In a way, these things can also be, I guess, related to each other. If you don't have these faith-based actors to be these go-betweens and to be able to enact this policy change, then we might end up with these policies that are then discriminating against them because they are not heard. And then we are stuck in this cycle of, you know, really discrimination against these Muslim-based actors and a disregard for, as you said, their needs. And as such an important group, of course, there should be more attention to incorporating them in the whole story as well. So if then we are thinking about how we can support or engage these actors a bit better, what are some of the ways to do this?
Well, first of all, what I would just like to add to what Paul's also been saying is that engaging Muslims engaging on environmentalism is not something new, right? Islam is a religion which is over 1400 years old, but fundamentally at its core and at its base, it is an environmentalist religion, right? It puts the earth and the stewardship of the land at the core of its tenet of its belief, you know, the principles of Islam. I mean, there's a book that's written by Rian Sen Ten Veen, and she's also Dutch, and it's called 199 Ways to Please God. And that highlights a lot of the sayings of the Quran and the Hadith that remind us that, you know, Islam, as well as other religions, do put the environment at the heart of what they believe in and our guidance for everyday life. So for me, it's not to teach people, you know, it's like what can we bring out of what's already there? So it's like, how, when we start engaging with people, let's start from this premise of not having a top-down approach to say, right, you are a Muslim community and we're going to tell you what to do. So it's more about saying, well, what are your guidelines and what can we learn from Islam and about environmentalism? What do you bring? What knowledge do you bring forward? What value do you hold? For me, that is probably the way to bring both Muslim communities, marginalized communities, and underrepresented communities to the forefront. And like Paul said, it's about giving people the voices and the platform, but not just about giving them the voices and the platform. You should also have the agency to act upon that as well. And I think that's where some of that disconnect in policy is. Sometimes the tokenistic instrumentalization happens, but then there's no agency to do anything beyond that. So for instance, an example is like There's funding available for SCIA. There's funding available for Equal Congregation to have that political voice at cost, at all the costs, to have that faith-based intermediary agency voice. However, for Muslim communities, there isn't that support there. So, you know, the question that I would ask is, why is that support not there? What can we do to support that support? And there's so many countries that are Islamic-based religious countries. And yet again, but the politics and the religion seem to be disconnected. It's like you could talk about politics, but you can't talk about religion, right? And for me, they are so interlinked. And even in the UK, where we think we're secular, politics are still underlined a lot with Christianity. So I think it's like trying to not shy away from bringing religion into politics, for a start, giving agency and not just voice is also just as important. And also resources and collaboration is also key as well. I think sometimes there's this expectation that communities, especially religious communities, can have the resources, the time, the people power, the manpower to get involved. And that's not always the case. A lot of these community groups, these Islamic community groups or Islamic institutes, are run by volunteers. And also they don't have like a head of state like Christianities do. So like Christian community groups and churches are run by a head of state that hold funds. A lot of the Muslim communities and the mosques aren't run like that. They're a much flatter hierarchy system. So they don't have finances, so they don't have the finances, they don't have the resources to get involved at a much higher political level, which I think we should also be aware of and acknowledge that.
From what I see, like what you just said, it seems to be about these three things you also mentioned in the end, you know, like listening, actually going to the communities and listening and learning from each other and embracing all the knowledge that can come with diversity and with including everyone in it. And then making sure that when you do it, you see it through until the end and you're not just, like you said, think they are engaging. The title of your article is so good. But then also providing the resources, you know, as you mentioned, going to COPs, that might be very expensive. Like if you look at the accommodation during a COP, you need like a lot of resources to be able to do those things. And I think that's an important point as well, that different faiths also might have different resources to be able to do these kind of activities. And we should also have like attention to that and try to encourage and engage everyone where that's possible. So thanks a lot for all of your interesting insights on this issue. As a final question, I always like to ask a more personal question. I think with the summer we've just had, it can be very difficult to still have hope for the future. You know, we see so much climate change impacts and things going wrong. So I was hoping that maybe you could give some hope then for us as well. Like, is there anything that you look that gives you some hope for the future yourselves?
I think, so I've been researching the politics of climate change for a decade now, and for me, it is a real challenge, and I'm so pleased that you've brought this up. I think one of the key things is to, what I would rather say to the listeners, is it's okay to have those days where you feel like the momentum has lost a bit, because it potentially will come back if you are kind to yourself and give yourself a bit of a rest. We aren't machines that can talk about existential threats every day for a decade without feeling that weight. And so there are many areas for positivity, I think, and that includes some of the voices of the interviewees we spoke to, who talked about being agents for change and the sheer volume of different activities that are taking place in the UK that are led by disconnected, powerful Muslim communities. But I would also say to the listeners, on those days where you don't feel that hope, then maybe tomorrow you'll feel differently, but just keep going while you can and take a rest when you need it.
Thanks a lot. And you, Zarina?
I think what gives me hope is, I think it's the many little things that the little wins can add up. So in my head, I see like a stone getting thrown into a pond and you see the ripple, and that ripple effect does happen. We might not see it straight away, I think, and that just gives me hope that there's many of these ripple effects happening all over the world. It might not be happening right now. And like, you know, I'm always frustrated that it's not happening quick enough. It's not happening soon enough. Why are people not doing enough? But I have to just step back and just like have that Zen moment to say, you know, it will happen. And we created it. So we as human beings created this mess we're in. And because we created it, we can also uncreate it. And I just feel as if the more we're connected to the land, the ecological system, and think of ourselves as being part of one ecosystem, get rid of the ego, bring in the eco. I think that gives me hope.
Yeah, that's such a nice catchphrase at the end as well. I might need to steal that. But yeah, thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, both of you, for having a bit of this uplifting message, and also Paul for acknowledging that sometimes it's also okay to be a little bit anxious about all of it and take some time to rest and maybe not scroll Twitter again 10 times a day. So thanks a lot for this. That's it for this episode. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe to How Green Is Your Deal on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you are listening. If you want to stay informed on Green Deal Net's activities, please go to greendealnet.eu and subscribe to the newsletter.